Okay, we're back. Welcome back to Evil Thespian. We are here today with Susanna Ugler. Susanna is a dancer, artist, and playwright. She works across choreography, theater, video, and performance. She teaches performance composition as an adjunct lecturer at the University of Pennsylvania. And she is currently in tech rehearsals for Cassandra, a Seder play written and directed by her, which previews May 18th. Susanna, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Me too. How's your day going? Do you have anything else going on today? Did you work or anything?
Yeah, I have a lot going on today. I'm technically supposed to be on the clock right now, you know, the joys of remote working.
that's my favorite thing about remote work, like, because I mean, I'm sure, like, you can relate to this, like, the acting and performing skills, like, really go a long way when it comes to pretending to be busy.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Lots of emails and tapping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm supposed to be, you know, I'm working right now. And then there's a few openings I'm going to later. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm preparing for the show next week. And yeah, it's just a busy, busy time.
Yeah. So you're in kind of like tech mode right now, a little bit.
Yeah, I'm starting tech technically next week, but I have kind of unfettered access to the space. So I've started kind of like, you know, installing the set a little bit, playing with lights. It's a super minimal tech team, which is basically me and one other person.
Perfect.
But yeah, really short staffed, but there is a lot of tech. So I've been trying to kind of get ahead of all of that before the dancers and the cast come in, and we kind of have to work with cues and everything.
What that's great that you have access to the space, because that must be good to have that buffer of time to sort of also like play around and have that visual reference before everybody comes in as well.
Totally. I mean, everything I make feels really dependent on the space. And yeah, I don't know. I always feel like I want to know where it's going to be presented, maybe even before I write a play. So yeah, I mean, this is lucky. I have like restaged certain performances in new spaces, and I'm always like, can I get 2 weeks in the space? They're like, you know, usually at most, and like often it's like 1 week, or like a few days before the show. But yeah, the space that we're showing the preview in is my studio, and I live here. It's like a big kind of industrial loft in Ridgewood, and I live here with a few other people, and the front space is like a very large, airy dance studio that we've kind of fitted for performance, which is super lucky.
Nice. How is the lighting? What's the lighting situation like?
The lighting situation, I have a bit of a hack, which is I got these like programmable like LED bulbs where you can kind of like, you know, you use your phone basically, and you can kind of dim them, go from warm to cold. I don't use the color. I have like a really strong aesthetic aversion to colored LED lights. Like I cannot.
Yeah.
So
you're definitely not the first person to have said that on this podcast. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. I like can't do the green, the red,
no.
The bisexual lighting.
It feels like, I mean, sometimes those LED lights are like fun, as in like the dollar store is like fun. Or like below five is fun, you know. But
really cute and kitschy and fun and funny sometimes. Yeah, I personally steer clear of them most of the time, and yeah, I kind of work on a pretty minimal, like warm to cold spectrum. I'm trying to get a spotlight though, because this play has like so many, kind of like Greek monologues that I feel like something more dramatic, like a spot, might be needed. So yeah, there might be a kind of old-fashioned spotlight, like handheld spot.
It would be a good like compliment, definitely. I mean, 'cause you have like like you said, the sort of like Greek like addressing the public kind of style. I minored in dance when I was an undergrad. I always remember like discovering the beauty of side lighting, because when we would have performances and we didn't have a big budget, but every show that we did had the same kind of lighting, just a bunch, two big like trees of side lighting, and it was always really it's so amazing how good something can look with just a little bit of side lighting, because it like highlights so many aspects of the body you can't get with, lights on right above you.
Side lighting, I haven't been able to work with since maybe I was an undergrad. But it was always, so flattering. You could see like muscle, curve, shadow. When I was an undergrad, it was like a really beautiful theater, like a state-of-the-art theater that we were working in, and it definitely spoiled me. Before I graduated, because I was like, oh, we have these amazing lighting designers from New York, and just like anything we want to build, we can just kind of say an idea and the tech team figure it out. And then, of course, becoming a professional, it's like way more DIY and scrappy
And sometimes dangerous, honestly.
Yeah, for sure. I'm like, I'm the one going up on the ladder right now.
Where did you go to undergrad for? Or where did you go to undergrad?
I went to Bard in upstate New York, and I majored in dance. I like tried to go there. I had like a really rigorous training as a young person, like in high school. As a teenager, I was like in this pre-professional dance company and touring, and was like taken out of school half day every day for the afternoon. So I had a really intense like pre-professional training as a dancer, and then it was like a choice to either go into conservatory training or do a liberal arts thing. And I like went to Bard, and I was kind of, swept off my feet a little bit by the environment, because it's so, romantic. It's a very romantic and beautiful campus. And I thought I would go there and stop dancing. Like I was like really ready to quit dance. And thought I would write more there, and just ended up being a dance major with like, a million little minors and concentrations, gender and art history.
So wait, so you had like all those minors?
I had like technically Bard doesn't have minors, but I did like a concentration. I was supposed to be doing like a double major in art history and dance, and then my last year I just like could not handle two senior projects with art history and dance, so I dropped out of art history in my senior year.
There's only so much knowledge out there,
I
you know?
know.
It's pressure. I'm like, I have to pick one,
It's only so much art, a 21-year-old can handle, I
I
think.
know. So many things to do. You have extra, you have activities to go to.
You've got
I
parties.
exactly. I remember when I went to Radford, we had sort of like the same kind of situation where technically I had a concentration in acting, But you could also do like these independent studies as well. But it sounds like, you had your undergrad environment was very sort of like collaborative in that you could sort of forge your own path a little bit.
Definitely. Yeah, and I ended up like taking classes in the theater department, performing in plays, and had my friends who were in the theater and performance department like perform in my senior project. So it was really kind of, they encouraged a lot of cross collaboration between disciplines and the film and the art department. And yeah, it's a very, interdisciplinary school.
Multifaceted, multiple dimensions.
Multifaceted. Yeah.
Was there a certain like, because I know our dance department was very like, this is the House of Graham, like wherever I go. I think when you, I don't know, when I talk to dancers sometimes, at least when I talk to ballet dancers, there'll be this discourse about different like modes or like methodologies of teaching dance. Was there a certain like methodology you come from, or was it more comprehensive?
Yeah, Bard was a very like experimental and postmodern kind of training program. I came in as a ballet dancer and was doing a lot of contemporary ballet, and yeah, I came in to Bard basically like a bunhead, and my teachers kind of like shook me down, and they were just like, "You're
And
not."
you left a bedhead.
Yeah, I left, turned in and messy, and yeah, so they were kind of doing not anything really classical. Like, I remember having a bit of a crisis when I was like in my first or second year, just like, I'm not going to be a dancer because this training isn't rigorous and I made a mistake. And that was before I kind of was like pushed by a professor of mine to get in to be a choreographer and to kind of like accept that. And yeah, the program was like they would have these kind of 2 year residencies with different New York City dance companies. So the first 2 years I was there, it was with this Bill T. Jones and Arnie Zane's dance company, which is a lot more contemporary, and kind of like he works a lot with like narrative, and there is kind of like a theater. He's like collaborated with Anne Bogart, so there is like a theater element, but the dance is so athletic, and yeah, it's very virtuosic and challenging. And then the second 2 years I was there, it was with the Trisha Brown Dance Company, which was like major for me, and it has its own methodology of kind of like linear movement and pedestrian movement. And yeah, we were really being trained in choreography and like how to make dance. And yeah, that was, I don't know, I think because they were working with artists from New York, from the city, it was really kind of, aside from those two companies, they would kind of pull choreographers, whoever was like really hot at the moment, and like they have no really kind of established methodologies, but would kind of teaching us like Feldenkrais, and there was one professor that was really into Alexander technique, which actually was something I did for a while that I kind of miss
I
because.
remember that was so like new and novel and exciting when I was an undergrad. Like there were Alexander Technique's like master classes, because they didn't my school, we just kind of did basic, good old like comprehensive methods, and Alexander Technique was like, oh wow, like what is very, very novel at the time.
I feel like in my Alexander Technique class, there were a lot of like jazz musicians and some theater students, but also a lot of non-dancers. And yeah, it just was kind of the first time that I felt like more in my body. Like my whole undergrad education was like, they would say these like drop your weight, like feel this differently, and it didn't really physically connect until the end of my time as an undergrad, and Alexander Technique was one of those tools that kind of helped me like have better alignment, like feel my posture, not be kind of moving like a ballet dancer all the time. And then I didn't really, I think, settle into a more like natural, easeful type of movement till after college and kind of freelancing for a while.
I'm still working on it. I feel like sometimes I'm like, well, I used to play the cello for like 10 years in my childhood, and I have like really, I've always had like really good posture, but walking, I guess, walking around as you do in acting class a lot. I've always had such a like insecurity of like I have very long arms. And we would have to film ourselves like moving. And when you watch yourself, your whole body reflected back at you in a way that's like not in a mirror. It's almost like kind of traumatizing a little bit in that setting, a classroom setting. But it really does like how we were talking about sidelighting, kind of taking a different like perspectives at all of these muscles and ways that everybody moves and kind of where what like points of weight they lead with is something I always think about all the time.
Yeah, watching a video of yourself in with a class, like in front of a class with your peers, does sound horrific. Sounds like everyone's worst nightmare, but maybe it's you just get used to that and then you become
Definitely.
desensitized. Yeah.
Definitely a lot of desensitization. Definitely a lot of tears, both good and bad. But I don't think I really didn't finish my dance minor, only because I think there was one Pilates class I just didn't take or I didn't have time. But I have very fond memories of my dance education, for that reason that kind of, everybody has sort of their own preferred methodology, but I think it always came down to the different type of language somebody uses to instill some like basic like physical principles of movement in you. And I think some different types of like linguistics in each method just works differently on depending who you are. So that's like my jazz class like really helped me with that because my teacher just had different ways of describing the body in ways that my acting teachers didn't. But it was like just exposing myself to like another perspective and how to look at stuff, which was re really great for my posture.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting that your program had like a focus in Graham because I never trained in Graham. I've taken a few classes here and there. So I know some of the basic like guidelines of Graham, and I've seen the company perform many times, but I don't know, the play I'm working on right now, I'm watching it and I'm like, this is so weird because it feels like Graham. And I was never trying for that, but she loves Greek tragedy. She loves mythology, and her stuff is so melodramatic, that, yeah, I don't know, it kind of has resonance.
Well, this is where the composition, like the principles of composition really come in because for those type of like Greek tragedies, you have to have like these very powerful tableaus. And my directing class, actually, I always say like my education in directing went kind of hand in hand with my choreography class because all we did was make tableaus with actors and just look at them and then talk about like, wow, what does this look like? Where's the tension in the space in between the two people? Like that's my fa one of my favorite things to do.
Yes. Yeah. I, as my cast knows, am like a huge sucker for tableaus. Like I feel like my recent work is kind of like that type of exercise on speed. Multiplied. I do a lot of tableaus, and it's even more in Cassandra, this new play, because we start working with like 20 images from like the Trojan War, like 20 kind of classical paintings, and like move through them and then kind of fuck with those images through choreography. And yeah, tableaus are so funny because they can be so classical and dramatic, but they can also be very subtle, and it can just be like, a still like stage blocking that communicates so much about the relationships. And yeah, like yesterday we were like, yeah, where your head is, like we were doing work that was just like, is your head tilted on this angle or this angle? Like what, and we spent so long with this last scene, me and two of the performers last night, just kind of getting the exact like placement of the body and the angles and the facings, because it, communicates so much.
And when you're directing, I know there's kind of a mix of how people choreograph or direct. Do you ever kind of direct the performers to try something or like lead with a different part of their body? Or are you kind of more of the person that will like go up there and like move somebody's arm?
I'm a little bit of both. I'm definitely more, well, I don't know. I think I've started, as I've gotten older, and like as I've started performing less myself for other people and really like spending more time writing and directing, I have gotten a bit out of my body. So I've been trying in rehearsals lately to be like, instead of just saying like, okay, do floor work here or something, or like, can you get up on the on your right knee or your left knee? Like, instead of being verbal, which is usually how I am, I've started to kind of go back to demonstrating in my body and trying to do. When I first started choreographing, I was in a lot of my own work, so it was kind of like anything I was making, I had to be able to physically do, or I wouldn't ask my performers to do it. And now it's different. Like I work with dancers who have a really different movement vocabulary than I do, and that's what's really beautiful to me about it, is this kind of play between movement that comes straight from my body. If I'm like choreographing like a phrase or something one day, or the way a character's walking, and I like, translate that to one of the performers. And then also this way of working where, the whole ensemble's on stage, and I ask like one character performer to try to just like drop a glass or like fall over. And the way that they do it, it can be so much more interesting to me than how I would do it. And I think that is because I have a really particular way of moving, and so does everyone. But some dancers are trained in this way where they are so versatile that they could take whatever notes. But I tend to work with people who, like me, have a very particular body type and movement quality, and it kind of already communicates a character,
I remember in dance there we had these conversations about, there were always those dancers that were so malleable, they could sort of blend in with any kind of style. And then there were those dancers, or even like actors in our program that had their own way of moving that was so static and like really came out in every single, style or performance that we were doing. And that was something that was always special because you always remembered them and you can sort of recall their character really easily. There's just like the uniqueness that like stands out, and I think the best elements of somebody's whole personality can like come out in just pitting them against something just very, just some sort of structure, like the style or the direction is not necessarily the thing that they need to do, but it's really what you're kind of looking for is like that uniqueness of how the person does it, that is like hard to verbalize, you know?
Yeah. I have a quick question for you. Can you hear the ruckus outside my window?
No, I cannot. Don't
Okay,
worry.
great.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh no, yeah. Honestly, I have a construction. The great uniter of this podcast is that everybody has construction going on outside of their window, including me, honestly. Somebody's building a rooftop. My neighbors are, and they've been working on it for the past 2 years. And
Oh my
yeah, it's all
God.
it's crazy because I'm like, of course somebody's like brand new rooftop construction like project is right next to my office. But yeah, crazy.
Yeah, everyone's like in a city where there's like constant noise outside the window.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like there's always construction here, and I live on a kind of a quieter street, but it's like before I lived in apartment that was very loud outside, just in terms of the cosmopolitan area. And now in this neighborhood I live in, it's loud in terms of the landscaping contractors that people hire to like plant flowers like year round, and like they're very loud. And there's like, I don't know, strange that landscaping is so crazy to me. I just did not know. Like I live sort of next to a college campus, so a lot of professors live in the area and there's nice houses. I just had no idea people spend so much on construction and landscaping.
Gardening.
So
Yeah.
yeah, owning property just sounds like the worst.
Yeah, the worst luxury.
Horrible.
I wouldn't want it
No, absolutely not. But what was I gonna say? Yeah, I think that what's interesting about composition to me is that everybody sort of understands like the basic concept. It's also like something that drives a narrative home so clearly. Something that really grinds my gears as a like from an actor perspective is when I see plays and the play is written really well, but there's a certain choreography and like tableau. And I feel that very strongly this way about furniture use as well, where I'm just like, why are we not putting the furniture here and the actor there, or they're having this conversation, and why is this person turned out this way? Because I'm just like,
Yeah.
wow, there's so much dynamic that could be layered on top of this story that would like really help me understand the play even more. Like I was watching that show that you did. The company, where there was like a table in the middle, and I really liked this element of like these, you know, performers like running around this table. There are a lot of kind of moving elements in that that I really liked.
Yeah, I think about that a lot. I mean, I was going to ask you more about furniture, but that the company was it was my most recent play. And I started it in grad school where I was like doing a visual art program. So I was like, oh, well, I should probably be making objects because everyone here is a sculptor. So I was like trying to make these bespoke tables. Just trying to build shit, which I can't do. And then I just ended up for the New York shows getting a really basic IKEA table because I was like, that's what would be in an office.
Perfect.
It would be this really simple industrial minimal IKEA table. And, you know, I stole these office chairs from Penn because they were like the art department's office chairs. I'm like, this is like, you know, what they would have in an art space. These kind of like sleek but also ugly like chrome and black leather chairs. Ugly because they were a little chunkier than like the kind of really sleek sexy Eames ones, but they're a bit cheaper. But
Oh yeah, like those gamer chairs kind of
yeah, it was somewhere
that are very
between like
popular.
a yeah like a gamer chair and like an Eames like swivel
Yeah.
chair. thing. Yeah, I that work and kind of all of my work so far deals with a kind of flattening of the space and the stage. And there are def I'm I am interested in like the depth of field and like kind of like what's happening upstage and downstage and this new plan, kind of like how can they be in like different conversations in the same room, or how can we kind of feel like we're, you know, in a much bigger space than we are. But a lot of the work that I'm doing with like blocking and furniture and like, you know, the set design I'm doing kind of is working with this like unrealistic, like flattening. Like the first one, the company was kind of like a void. Like there were no other objects except for the table and chairs. There were no props. It was meant to be very sparse and kind of like no place. You feel like you're in an office, but it's really nondescript. So that the kind of narrative of like what this company is could unfold. And then this Cassandra is the first play where I'm actually working with, well, I wouldn't say the first, but I'm working with props very intentionally. And there's more of a set and more, I wouldn't call it furniture because it is all like kind of handmade set pieces, but yeah, there's a sort of like you know, unrealistic nature that the objects in the set are kind of bringing to the work.
Yeah, I mean, any kind of object, whether it's like a big, like ominous set piece or a very small like property, I guess. That to me, I guess as an actor, it's such a powerful tool to manipulate tension, because the story and the tension in this narrative is like so contingent on the performer's relationship to the object and how close they are from the object, how far away, if they're, you know, faced to the object or away from it. Like I always say, when I see a play and everything's just right on the perimeter, I'm like, that's fine, but bring some things in, maybe even in the middle. Yeah, like right in the middle of the stage, because it creates some dynamics, but also it's sort of just a tool to direct, you know, your audience's line of focus. All of these different things that are like really fun to play around with.
Do you feel like you've seen works where people are like intentionally avoiding the center?
I have, that's a really good question. Not really. I've seen more plays where they're too, maybe too centered. A lot of it is like really, really centered.
Yeah.
And all the objects are like, I don't know where they are, or like
Yeah.
but yeah, but it's interesting that you mentioned kind of like non-set pieces. Like when I think of a chair, if it's like just like in a play, like where it's, if I'm just doing like a kitchen sink play, I'm like, oh no, there's a purpose for this chair, no matter where we're gonna put it. But what's interesting is like, I guess when you're doing more, if you have like a different type of object, it can be a lot like m more malleable a little bit, I think. I don't, yeah, but I've never seen anybody like intentionally avoid the center. However, I do like it when people play with like the perimeter and get re make use of like the space, because I think that's the most important, is like you have this space and like have to really take advantage of every square inch.
Yeah,
Yeah,
data.
get your money's worth.
Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. We were talking, oh yes, you were you gonna say something?
Yeah, I don't know. I was just gonna say that there's one of the object set pieces that I'm working with is in this new play. There's a bar that's like upstage center. That one, like the characters kind of float around and like come back to you. And one character in particular is like always at the bar. And as a placeholder, before I was like building it, because I was like running out of time to build everything, put in one of my ballet bars for my studio, and
Perfect.
yeah, one of my collaborators was like, why don't you keep that? It's a bar. It's like a, it's a,
Yeah.
and there's dance in it. That character is kind of like a retired, a failed dancer. Like I was like, oh, this is maybe an interesting space to play with for this like preview, is that the objects are still kind of like references of, they're not the real thing,
Yeah.
like a table. They're like a reference of, a bar, or it's the reference of like an event space or a party, but it's not really, we're in a dance studio. So I don't know,
Yeah.
I could like that play with set pieces and furniture and objects kind of being also a little abstract.
Yeah, I mean, that is, to me, I'm like, that's so important to you get as much as you can out of an object. If a ballet bar doubles as like a real bar, that there, then it's like, oh yeah, I can do anything with this one object. And I think that's really, yeah, that's really interesting, because sometimes you'll be in rehearsal and you use like rehearsal props, and then when the rehearsal props go away, I've been like, oh, you know what, I do miss that stick I was using as a telephone,
Yeah, it had a nice ring to it.
yeah, or it was
Yeah.
so I could, yeah, do so many things with it. But yeah, that is really cool. And also, I think for practical reasons, sometimes I'm like, why go out and get the real thing, because that is gonna be so chunky and I can only use it for one thing. and I'm gonna have to like roll it around. But yeah, I was thinking, we were talking earlier a little bit about, like, as theater communicators, we were talking about sort of the taxonomies of different types of performance art. And you mentioned, like, you feel some kind of way about, like, this phrase, dance theater. Can you speak to that?
I mean, I feel like, well, so many people like ask me how I categorize my work, especially once they've seen it. They're like, is this it's really like formally experimental. And it is, it's very heavy in dance, but it's narrative. There's like a full script, lots of dialogue, very coherent narrative. The character development is one of the most like interesting, important parts of it to me. And yeah, so most dance these days, especially like, I don't know, contemporary dance. I don't know. There's an avoidance of narrative. So I feel like, and kind of like clear dialogue in a lot of dance. And when we say like dance theater, I feel like the work that comes to mind is either Pina Bausch, which is like perfect example, like icon, or it's something like Sleep No More, which like, I've never been, so I can't say I have anything against Sleep No More. And they just closed, and I like, missed my chance to go see it with friends, not knowing it was closing, and now I'll never know. But there's something about dance theater where there are very few, I mean, obviously there's a lot of companies and artists I know that work in dance theater, but I think the public can associate with that like medium, and they seem to have their own kind of like stylistic, just like it's a style, it becomes like a style or an aesthetic that's like a little vaudeville, which I like, but I haven't seen a lot of dance theater that feels actually contemporary, like actually pushing a form, or like that the narrative is kind of like kind of trying to like dissect something that is very contemporary. That the characters feel like they might be people you know. Like, I've never seen a dance theater piece where there are characters that feel like I would know this person.
Yeah, dance theater, like the phrase sounds very, only like very surface level a little bit to me.
Yeah.
I think like, oh, dance theater, what is that, postmodernism? Or I don't know,
Mm-hmm.
so Yeah, I think you're definitely onto something there where there's not a lot of like public association with really what you're trying to do, like very specific, like narrative driven kind of form. Does the dance world kind of, I'm actually, I don't know, does the dance world like look down like on narrative? Is that a very like lowbrow thing?
I think for a while it was. I think there's an aversion to it because it's not done very well, if I'm being honest. Like, there's some dance companies and choreographers that work with text very well. Bill T. Jones being one of them. And then there are people like Yvonne Rainer who, you know, like she wrote, I don't know if you like studied her in school. Like she was very much like a bard, like postmodern icon for me and my dance education. But she's like most known for doing the No Manifesto, which is, you know, like the rejection of virtuosity, spectacle, beauty, seduction, narrative, character, and like, you know, saying yes to like minimalism, pedestrian movements. And she's even come out as saying like, and that kind of defined like postmodern dance in a lot of ways. And she's come out since kind of like rejecting that manifesto that she wrote in the 70s. And right after that, and like some of her famous works, like Trio A, she turned towards filmmaking and started doing narrative film. And those are some of my favorite works of hers, but she wasn't doing narrative and performance. She was doing narrative for film. So she started making films that were, you know, where she would cast the same people that would dance for her as actors. So I don't know. I feel like the contemporary landscape for dance right now, there's so much more text that's happening in dance. There's definitely play with character that's happening. And this is like, I'm thinking of like the New York downtown dance scene, which is very specific. And I have seen some people, I think, like try to do making what they would call plays. So I don't know. I think like there is more kind of like interest in narrative. But it does feel kind of like wholly, like there isn't really a space in the field for it. Like dance, like visual art, which are the two like fields I've presented my work in. They have really specific parameters of like what showing performance is, and often like theater plays don't really actually fit the parameters of like a gallery space or a dance studio. Like they don't have, you know, they don't do these kind of complicated tech cues or expect the audience to be there for over an hour and a half or over
Yeah,
a half hour.
that makes sense because when I go to a gallery or a museum and there's some performance artist there, it feels so awkward because I'm like, what is this? Like, am I supposed to leave? Or it feels like it's its own kind of thing where it's like, I don't know if this is a play or if they're dancing. Yeah, sometimes it's like, people like don't know where to put different things. But I also think that like the character aspect in the dance world is sort of like the character building in the dance world can sometimes not be, dug into as much. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the work I have performed in that's not my own, if I was like cast intentionally by someone, it was usually because they were like, I want to work with character. Like, and I'm not an actress. I struggle a lot with voice. So like modulating my, you know, projecting, modulating my voice, which is probably why I work the way I do with like voiceover. But yeah, character also in the body is something that I feel like I was often like hired to do or cast to do characters. And I feel like dance theater, that genre definitely works with character more than it does narrative. It's like character and world building without narrative that's fleshed out in the text, if that makes sense, or without
Yeah.
like and kind of, not that my work is realist or naturalistic, but like there's such a bridge, I think, between like dance theater, general dance theater, and I don't know, theater or dance. It's just like a funny, it feels more like a style to me.
Yeah.
But
Did you, by chance, did you study Isadora Duncan at all?
I studied Isadora Duncan when I was in high school. I did like an art history project on,
Okay.
but I never like trained, like I never learned any of her pieces or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, she was a huge, like, how do I say it? A Hellenophile. Like, she was very obsessed with like the Greeks, and she like built a whole compound on a random Greek island. She was kind of this crazy like postmodern icon, and her thing is like very like classically Greek, but the style is like flailing, gyrating, witchy woman, because that's kind of who she was. She was kind of crazy. But I always I was thinking of her because I was thinking of sort of like the melodramatic motifs you have going on here with Cassandra. Well, so let's talk about that. What is Cassandra? Can you give us like a little plot brief?
So Cassandra is a very loose adaptation of Euripides' The Trojan Women. And yeah, I'm calling it a satyr play because The Trojan Women is, a tragedy, and it's extremely tragic. There's like no line in it that's not tragic. Which was interesting because I was trying to write a comedy because my last play felt heavy. And yeah, I guess I've been saying that the last play was a tragedy with some good jokes in it, and this play is a comedy with a very tragic ending. And yeah, it's a very loose adaptation of The Trojan Women, which is about the fall of Troy, and it kind of details what happens to each woman of Troy, like her fate. And it's just it starts with Hecuba, the dethroned queen of Troy, kind of collapsed in agony and despair, and she stays on the ground for the entire play. And I was really interested in that image, just like what would it look like if I had one dancer who never got up, and the whole like action had to happen around her the entire time. Yeah, especially because everything for me has to like move, and the I don't know, there's so much movement that I'm like, can I work with having one person that never moves?
Well, yeah, I mean, talk about objects and like set pieces. Like, that's kind of its own set piece that is sort of like to be used in sort of like a feng shui way.
And I'm like, there's a scene that Hecuba is not in, but she has to stay on the stage. I'm like, we're not getting up. You're never ever getting up. So it's a lot of like, how does it, I don't know, how can we pretend, I don't know, make it feel as though the conversation that she's not supposed to be hearing, she really doesn't hear it, because she might be there like an object, but she is not like there. So right, it's kind of set in the day after the fall of Troy, and in the original, there's a soldier, a messenger from the Greeks, Talthybius, who's just kind of coming to Hecuba throughout the play, telling her of like her different daughters' fate, her son's fate. And one of her daughters is Cassandra, who in Greek mythology, I don't know if you're familiar with her. I feel like you must
Yeah,
be.
I, cause we're, cause my husband and I were just talking about, like, I was like, Greek names, and I was like, oh yeah, that one. I totally, it escapes my mind, actually.
Yes, it's a great name, Cassandra.
Oh yeah, so good. Yeah.
Cassandra is One of Hecuba's daughters, who was a prophet, a priestess, and Apollo, the god, fell in love with her, but she was not interested in him. She rebuffed him, and he cursed her by spitting in her mouth and, cursing her to tell true prophecies, but nobody would believe her. And she was the person who predicted the Trojan horse and told, everyone not to take the Trojan horse, and nobody listened to her. And everyone thought she was a lunatic. So she's like the original
Classic.
hysterical woman.
It really, like, people would, I mean, it's like the ultimate cautionary tale about denying a woman's intuition, because it's like our whole lives are set up just to be like, I told you so,
And she is, the thing I like about her is she is nuts. I mean, like when you, if you're not believe, if people don't, believe anything you say, you start to feel crazy, when people
You
tell you you're crazy.
you start to deny your own reality or question your own reality, because it's like, no, like whenever you have like an intuitive feeling about something, like, and nobody else, everybody else is like saying you're crazy, but and then, and it's just like, so also it's like so frustrating as a woman to be like, I listen, I'm just saying, and also in the future I'm going to be also saying I told you so, nothing I can do, I guess.
Hate to use the phrase gaslit, but
Yeah, oh yeah, that is what it is.
I'm interested in this. Well, I mean, I really wanted to write. I think there is a play called Cassandra, or like some adaptation, several adaptations of the narrative that have been turned into theatrical plays. I mean, it's interesting because I'm titling the play Cassandra because that was the original idea I had, was I want to focus on this character. I'm so interested in this character and what a modern Cassandra would be. That's not so obvious because there were some obvious choices in the culture I could make of like who is a modern day Cassandra. But yeah, what it really is an adaptation of the Trojan Women because it's an ensemble play. And Cassandra is one part of the whole ensemble that I probably feel just like affinity for, and kind of she is a prophet, so I kind of want the key, I don't know, the key lines to kind of like be told through her. And she kind of carries the ending. But yeah, it's, I mean, the adaptation is that it is kind of like multifaceted talent agency. They're kind of like an agency of like model artist hybrid. So like each girl, each of Hecuba's daughters, kind of is a model, but also a poet, also a noise musician, or like I don't know, has like some sort of like edgy, it's like a very like downtown New York, like we have agency. And
I was just gonna say, I was like, this sounds like l when you have that friend who's like, I started a studio and we have a website and we have a space. And it's like kind of like when you go to like someone's studio website and you don't know really what it is. I'm like, is this an agency? There are models, there are musicians, but there's also a rental space. What is this?
I only know a few of those, and I feel like it's kind of a nice thing for the artist, if it is like a really small thing, like a nice thing for the artist to be able to be like, oh, I have an email associated with an agent so that when I'm reaching out to press or something, I can have some sort of like fake credential that makes them take me more seriously. But yeah, I was interested in this kind of like hacked together talent agency. I was interested in Hecuba. She really felt like a madam to me in the original. Her girls are basically being like sold off as like sex slaves in the Trojan Women. And Athena and Poseidon are kind of the gods connected to the fall of Troy. So it's kind of like a Condé Nast is like buying up some like little like downtown New York talent agency, fashion agency you've never heard of. And everybody's getting kind of hysterical and petty. And yeah, there's some threads to my last play, which kind of touch on the fear of the hyper professionalization of the artist, which I talk about a lot, just kind of this fear of like corporate culture, and honestly, like a fear I have of like identity politics in art and performance and culture, kind of like being, I don't know if violent is the right word, but kind of thinking about like tokenization in fashion and in art and how people are kind of chosen and selected, and the people kind of who have the money behind the scenes, if somebody is ever to like make it in any of these kind of very precarious industries.
What is so frustrating about that too is like in a very precarious like subculture of people, there's always this tension that you feel to be some kind of way. And then when you see somebody else being some kind of way, and like making money off of it, it's like, wait, why wasn't it me, you know?
Yeah, why
And then
wasn't
also, then also it's like, oh wait, no, I have to be a different kind of way to like do this other thing. And then you start questioning who am I, you know?
that? Yeah, I feel like there's a lot of conversations I have with my friends, who are like either performance artists or visual artists or musicians or writers, like just kind of like the aversion to kind of like self-promotion and self-identifying, and you know, really like self-identifying in a way that would get you like grants or like press or something. And yeah, seeing people who, but also kind of like coming to this place where it's like, well, you kind of can't hate on people for playing the game, you know what I mean? For like doing what has been rewarded in these industries.
And there's always that question of I want to be myself, but I also don't want to deduce myself to these very surface level aspects of who I am because I'm multidimensional, multifaceted. And
Of course. Yeah, I don't know. I think a lot about stereotypes, and there's definitely the characters in my work all feel like stereotypes, but I kind of try to just like understand base desires and motivations and give them more depth through that. But yeah, I'm always curious for actors because I, like we were talking earlier, kind of about like the body, like some dancers that can be, you know, I don't know, can do everything, and some that are very particular. And I feel like it's probably the same with actors. Like there's a desire to be like, in my, you know, understanding, there's a desire to be like a canvas or like a, you know, a blank page or something, but also there are definitely character actors who maybe can't transcend what they are, you know, or how people see them.
I think especially like as a actor, you're sort of taught to lean into what are so just like there's these things that are just like the principles of our like physical shape. So if I'm someone who's like a very large person, that I can't really transform myself into a smaller person, but it's kind of like the concept of makeup. Like makeup is supposed to enhance your features that are already there, and I think as an actor, you're really taught to press into the things that like you're just your natural strengths, and find your own different kind of muscles that activate things that maybe. You don't normally get typecast as. And sometimes, you know, other people are, you know, you can do so much work and people are like, you know, I just get typecast as this one thing and that's my job and I do it so well and better than anybody else. And I'm the best at this, at these like three different characters. And I think that is kind of how I see it, where it's like there's some things that are unique about me that make me not a good fit for something else, but make me the perfect fit for this other thing. That's kind of how I see it a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But,
yeah.
Yeah. I think so much of how I like, I think about casting so much. And I don't know, it feels like a lot of the way that I'm working, which has like voiceover of like a different, usually a different voice than the performer's voice, and then like embodied by somebody else, and kind of the textual clues sometimes are also like, oh, that person's Jewish, you know, like
really yeah.
Jewish. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And like kind of playing with like expectations of like a personality or a character definitely comes from my feelings performing as a dancer. And for a long time, like when I was kind of freelancing as a professional dancer, I was cast in a lot of or hired for a lot of like museum and gallery gigs, where probably maybe not on like dissimilar to what you're describing, like walking into a gallery being like, what is that person doing?
Yeah.
I, you know, like would be in museums, mm-hmm. like have to be like under a blanket for like an hour or something, and just kind of feeling reduced to an object, but also like all of these frustrations around like, oh, I'm only ever going to be seen as like this type of dancer, this type of body,
yeah.
even in daily life, like my voice is like this. And people, you know, make, you cannot control people's assumptions and judgments. And mm-hmm. so I don't know, my work is kind of playing with that, because I guess as a, not an actor, and some of my dancers are trained actors, but, and some of them are not even trained dancers. Some of them are just like my friends, where I'm like, you know, working with them because they can move and they have an interest in it and they're an interesting looking person and, you know, have a presence. But yeah, it's kind of like these people maybe can't as easily transcend what people are going to associate with them. So how can like the text and the dialogue and like the sound of the voice kind of complicate those expectations people kind of have when they first sit down?
Yeah, I was gonna say, like, would, as a dancer, there's such a tendency, or you're sort of like vulnerable to that sort of objectification. I feel like sometimes as an actor, I'm like, oh yeah, I like do feel very objectified, but in a lot of, you know, narrative driven, like there's the text, I can, you know, vocalization, like all of these things that sometimes you don't find as much in the dance world. I can definitely see how it feels a little alienating to just be like this ominous, vacant, feel like sort of like a vacant vessel a little bit, like floating around, kind of like searching for, you know, I'm like, where's my voice gonna go a little bit? Definitely.
Yeah, no, it has been very strange before. I think I also, after like most of my life, or like, yeah, most of my life being a dancer, and then kind of it amounting in a career that was like that. I think I just have like a bit of like a chip on my, maybe not a chip on my shoulder, but a little bit of like friction, like frisson with dance as a field and its limits. I mean, I also, this is working not commercially, you know, that's a whole different world, but yeah, working as an experimental dancer and performance artist, I was like, I really don't want to be, and this was a personal choice, because like, where would I be without the dancers that want to be a character for my vision? But you know, I kind of ended up just feeling very strongly like, I don't want to be this kind of like voiceless, not muse, but like body that like is translating somebody else's thing. But
Right.
that's to me the beauty of acting. I don't know, like, where would we be without actor?
Yeah. Well, I think, in an acting context, it's, completely. It's so funny because I feel this way, like, outside, like, when I step out of a character, or I have to, like, talk about the character that I'm not, or just, like, being, I guess, like, the concept of being yourself. But it, how you were talking about, like, this pressure to identify yourself with something specific, to accomplish some certain political goal, is really overwhelming. Like, to me, I feel that sort of mechanism of, like, I want to be myself. But then when people are like, yeah, be yourself, then they're like, wait, no, not like that. Like, you can, like, that's not what we're talking about. We're actually talking about this other person who's being themselves. I'm like, well, and then I feel like I gotta be that person's self. And then I'm like, well, I'm an actor on the stage and off the stage. And I can see how famous actors could be overwhelmed by that, because you kind of have to do that as well. Which is why I'm like, wow, it really must be very hard to be that much of a public-facing person. But I don't have a. Like, Nike endorsement deal or anything, so I can say what I want. If you could describe, I guess, your style in one word, what would it be?
My style?
Or I guess aesthetic, or I don't know.
Ooh, that's so hard. I feel like whatever word I say is going to be wrong. How does that say cold? It feels cold.
Cold. Ooh,
I
I like that. I
think
like
that's
that a
only
lot.
one facet of it.
Yeah, yeah.
And
That's
that,
an element.
and that is a little different in this one because it's so much funnier and more absurd. Cassandra, it really feels farcical. And that is really different than my past two, like longer plays were very like cold. Who know, also like irreverent, but that's, also facet. But that's a
That goes
tough.
along with, like, the farcical elements, I think, as well. I think what I always struggled with as a performer is doing, 'cause more satirical, like, slapstick and, like, comedic roles always came so natural to me. When I would have to do work that is very, very self-serious and very so dense, I'm like, where is the joke in this? 'Cause I'm always looking for the joke. I really like anything that's really satirical and kind of bombastic and melodramatic, because there's such a it like really unites everybody a lot. And, like, these little things that are just very easy and fantastic entryways into a story, kind of, even stereotypes, it's sort of like that entryway into the narrative, which is, yeah, like, I remember I did Anything Goes in college, and that was, like, one of my favorite projects I ever did, because to me, I'm like, oh, this is so easy for everybody. I at least for me, I guess, I felt. But yeah, that is the great thing about, like, the satirical element, is that the irony is really accessible, and also it is a great canvas for, like, so many great conversations.
I think without the jokes, the audience would not be like receptive, I feel like it would be, or it would be harder. It would be harder, I think, for me to kind of like, I don't know, move people if they weren't kind of like titillated but with like humor first. So yeah, I don't know. I think that my plays are both tragic and comedic and, kind of shift on the levels of that. Yeah, I don't know. I also think that there's a big element to them that is really disorienting, because there is this deconstruction of the body and the voice, and yeah, I don't know if I've like clearly articulated it like in, for the podcast, but like the dialogue is being kind of played back from like voice actors, and the dancers are pantomiming it, but not always. Like sometimes they're pantomiming it, sometimes they're miming, other times they are trying to be as like precise and naturalistic as possible in their gestures and movements and their like inhales and exhales. Other times it's like completely abstract dance, and they kind of drop the they drop the pantomime, and the choices of when that happens in what scene and when it changes is kind of the choreography that I'm doing, is like, when is this conversation becoming like a fantasy for someone, or like when is the conversation becoming really like difficult and cold, and like when is someone alienated, and how can the subtext of the conversation or the dialogue be kind of traced out in the style of movement and the bodies? And yeah, the dancers I work with are so great at like playing with me while I'm like, okay, try it, like turn the dial up on abstraction. No, now go back to naturalism for this word, like. But I do think it's disorienting to watch and a bit alienating, but I think again, the humor kind of helps to buffer the alienation that I'm kind of teasing out in the world that the characters are in.
Yeah, I was just thinking about like the concept of humor. Like sometimes it really can be like this very nice buffer of like, wow, that's very humorous. But on a deeper level, there's humor is also about that feeling of like, oh, interesting that you did that there. That's curious. Like I wasn't expecting that.
Yes.
That's like it's such a good tool to evoke curiosity and like evoke questioning. And it's like something that's so important. I think also in more like non-satirical work as well, you kind of always have to be thinking of like not necessarily where's the joke, but where is the gotcha moment that is
Yes.
like driving the
Yeah.
tension. And I said this the other day to my friend. I was like, oh, why is life just like put, well, I just gotta put you in a gotcha. Everybody's trying to put me in a gotcha moment. And it's almost like a cynical, it's also kind of like a cynical way because of thinking as well. Like those are like all of the elements in that. And it's great to be also comedic, like in a physical way as well. That's such a fun thing as a performer. There are a lot of experimenting and stuff like that. What would you say are like the main like themes that Cassandra like bring like the play evokes?
Well, one thing that was not intentional when I went into it, and now the more I see it kind of getting closer to its finished state, it really feels to me like it's kind of about leaving your 20s. So kind of about yeah,
Bye-bye.
bye.
Sayonara.
Saying bye to, yeah, I'm like just, I'm like, I'm old.
Wait, you just turned 20 just...
30,
or 30?
30.
Oh, okay. I was gonna say I turned 30 in like, oh God, like a couple months here. I'll be 30 in July,
God.
and it feels great to leave that far behind me and
I
pretend
know.
like it never happened.
Yeah, I mean, it's really like, I feel like I've been 30 in my mind for a while, but then it happened and I'm like, wow, it's like a new world here. But yeah, I don't know. It's kind of like Cassandra is this character who is so tragic because It's not just that people don't believe her, but it's that she is kind of alone in her ideologies, and everyone around her is kind of like grown up, so to speak. Everyone else is kind of like, welcome to the world. This is how things work. And she's kind of like, this isn't how things should be. She's constantly like, this is, this isn't how things should be. This is bad, like making moralistic judgments. And the people around her are adults and are kind of, jaded, or hardened to the fact that they have to operate in certain ways. So that's one theme, is kind of just like that aspect of growing up, of like when people become kind of hard, and less starry-eyed and idealistic, and also just like kind of failed ideologies in general, maybe. Impending collapse is a theme, like the fall of Troy, like, the fall of America, or some sort of metropolitan city or project that, I don't know, this is always kind of a theme in my life, is like the looming collapse.
The collapse of my wild imaginative interior
Yeah.
life.
Yeah, the collapse of I don't know, like, oh,
My
my
inner
art.
monologue.
There's another theme also that is probably the most, like, I hate to use this word, like zeitgeisty, whatever. The most, I don't know, like dialogue, discoursey theme, which is, there's a little bit, Cassandra, the character, the way I fleshed out the character, is that she has a little, these visions that are very like tinfoil hat moments. She's like conspiratorial, she's paranoid, and she has a few speeches about like the longhouse that they're in. So there is this kind of thematic interrogation of like connected to like identity politics, like kind of female women left spaces, and like, like these spaces that are kind of on paper meant to be more ethical, and the kind of like toxicity of kind of insisting upon, like, I don't know,
Pulling back the curtain.
I don't know. So it's funny. It's about like a matriarchy, but it's not really a matriarchy, the construction of that, and
The collapse of institutions and
Yes, for sure.
definitely the reckoning with the institutions that you didn't think were going to collapse or thought were infallible, I think is
Yes.
something a lot of people can connect with because there are all these institutions that like people like sign their livelihoods away to,
Yeah.
and I think there is a sense of, I guess definitely, yeah, like your 20s or exiting your 20s, there's sort of a feeling of almost shame or embarrassment for being like the starry-eyed young person who's like obsessed with a certain idea or institution. That is some like that is hard to reckon with. Because it is sort of like once you, yeah, exit your 20s, you kind of like, wait, I want to be like nice to the younger version of myself, but I'm also like kind of shameful of her.
For sure.
That's hard, yeah.
I was much more, I mean, I'm still a kind of like, I don't know, can be a hot-headed person, but I was just so much more reactive when I was younger, especially in like the early half of my 20s. And there's certainly a shame. I feel like so many of my friends are like, I'm so embarrassed about how like political I thought I was. They're
I
like,
thought I
angry
was on to
me.
something. I really was changing the world.
People are like, I'm embarrassed at how I talk to my parents
Yeah.
and my family members. Like, yeah, perhaps. So yeah, I don't know. The collapse of institutions. was a really heavy theme in the last play I did, The Company, the collapse of any sort of like kind of infrastructure that one could rely on, and kind of like, I don't know, I feel like I'm thinking a lot about how hard it is to be an independent performing artist and how there is very little infrastructure, like financially. I don't know. I have a friend who's trying to get into like production design for stage, and he was been like interning with this projectionist, this projection designer, and this designer was like, yeah, I mean, the performing arts have no money. Theater has like pretty much none, but no one's as poor as like the dance world. Like there's like no.
That is so true. I was wondering about that because I can't imagine like the dance community is, it's small already. And also, as dancers are like the last people who like, I feel like they just, even you're the most like, you could be like the most well tenured like a dancer in your space, and you just don't get paid at all. Am I onto something?
Yes, yeah, no, dancers don't get paid at all. And I have been in like so many conversations and spaces with dancers that kind of always come back to this, and I've like written a lot about it, but like they kind of come back to this point, which is like, but we do it for love, you know? And
Oh,
that is,
yeah.
you know, a beautiful romantic notion, but I don't really think that's I just think the last play was kind of about it ended up being about like a perform like a dance slash theater company, and the kind of resentments that come with like minimizing yourself and your needs for like the romantic notion of, you know, being a part of a work that you love or being a part of something that doesn't give you what you need. But, you know, I don't know. It's just, I feel like so many dancers are like, yeah, like we do it for love. And for me, they're like, yeah, it sucks. And there's a lot of complaints about it. But to me, I'm just like, I mean, maybe there should be a bit more of a thrust behind, like, there isn't a dance union. There's like a fake union. I'm just like, I don't know what's going on with like dancers. I think part of it is literally that they're the most like kind of ephemeral, like not material people. But then I've also encountered a lot of dancers that like can't kind of reckon with the fact that their material needs are going to affect their like psychic space. And
I was gonna say, like, this has happened to me before when I've been on a job and I'm clearly being underpaid, but it's like, no, like, I'm an artist, like, I'm a genius. And then I like wake up one day, I'm like low on iron, and I'm like, wait a minute, like I didn't mean that, like I didn't know this was gonna make me anemic, and I'm like, maybe I should not be living like a dog, because also as a dancer, it's like my idea is that like I would pay the dancer as much as I could because they need to like be
Or not.
athletic, my, what's crazy? What a world we live in where you can work at a tech company and you get a fully subsidized Equinox subscription, and yet when you're a dancer, crumbs.
Don't get health insurance.
It's crazy to me.
No Equinox. If you're lucky,
No.
maybe like Blink or Crunch.
Crunch,
I don't
yeah.
know. You're
I
paying
still
for him.
haven't canceled my Planet Fitness subscription. It's still on my credit statements, and it's just, it feels like very, you're like, wow, am I being scammed? Yeah, I think definitely when you were talking about like that sort of like embarrassment or shame that comes with like the minimizing yourself, sort of.
And then, you know, I also understand, like I've done everything I've done has been underpaid, you know? So I get it. It's like if that's the way that the field is operating, you either opt in or out and kind of can't be the Cassandra like running around like, guys, we should organize. Like, why aren't you fighting? Like, do you have the energy to, you know, fight for better working conditions? And also there's just no oversight. There's no one you would go, there's no industry to really like complain to or report to. Like, it's just interesting. And yeah, I think dancers are probably the most like either like most artists in New York, you know, come from family wealth, or you're probably like extremely impoverished in New York, and it's kind of a young person's game anyway, dance and perform.
I
I
was
mean,
gonna say, like, there's sort of a shelf life, a little bit, because your body kind of, or your muscles atrophy, or like certain, or you just get tired. You know what? That's something, being almost turning 30, like, I'm so tired.
yeah, and it's hard living in certain cities. Yeah, people get really tired and you don't have energy for rehearsal after like, working your day job all the time. So, it is interesting. I'm curious if it's ever going to change. I just think it's going to maybe keep getting smaller and more selective and like more precarious, which yeah, that kind of anxiety and sadness is like all over my work. Is like, is this, you know, it? Like people are getting bitter and tired and like and I don't know if it's just the dance world, but I do think in the visual art world there's certainly more money in like the art world. But I know that the kind of feelings, the themes of precarity and resentment are really present for people I know working in visual art as well.
Sometimes you can like feel it on people where it's like, that's why I'm like, oh, I can t when people are like resentful sometimes in public, I always like have a soft spot for it 'cause I'm like, oh, I kind of know where you're coming from, you know. Definitely. Well, we're coming up on time, so let's plug away. Where can we find you?
My Instagram is, it's an annoying little handle. It's like underscore S00ZE
Love
underscore
that.
Suze with two zeros.
Perfect.
Yeah, and on my Instagram there is an Eventbrite link to tickets for the preview of Cassandra. It's May 18th and 19th. There'll be three shows, and then there'll be some more dates in later in the year, that I'll probably announce on my Instagram.
Perfect. Well, I will link away. And Susanna, thank you so much for coming on the show once again.
Thank you. It was so fun.
Yes,
Thank you for
and
having me.
of course, and scene.